Friday, August 16th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Yesterday in Bedminster, New Jersey, Donald Trump gave remarks. Among them, he relayed an interesting news item he claims to have come across.
You can ask the man on the street. I saw it on one of the shows today. They asked the man on the street, what's the last name of Kamala? Nobody knew. It's Harris. Nobody knew the last name. I don't even use it because nobody knows who I'm talking about. People don't know who she is.
Well, I'm going to say it might have been a flawed experiment. The independent variable was Kamala Harris's first name. But if you say Kamala, you're throwing the whole experiment off. Of course, Trump has also tried this line in front of crowds, but with the other syllable emphasized.
Kamala Harris. You know, it's interesting. Nobody really knows her last name. If you ask people, do you know what her last name is? Nobody has any idea what it is. Harris. It's like Harris. I don't know. How the hell did this happen?
Huh. You know, it really does call into question if he heard that man on the street interview yesterday, as he was saying he did, if he was talking about it days before in Bozeman. I think we got him. Old Donnie Trump's not going to be able to slip out of this one. The other day, we chronicled how he said Kamala. Oh, Kamala. How he goes up and down. Sometimes it's Kamala. Sometimes you don't know. How the hell? Does he say it correctly? Does he say it incorrectly? The answer is yes to both. Others have pondered this question, drawing conclusions. This was Verge editor Nilay Patel on the Power User podcast.
He said Kamala Harris's name in five different ways.
Kamala, 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 Kamala.
And you can tell that he says her name wrong when he wants to insult her even more.
You know, I don't think so. It doesn't seem that important. That is true. I will stipulate that. But it does perhaps get to two competing theories of Donald Trump. One, handsome. Two, very handsome. One, kind of an evil genius, knows what he's doing, a malefactor who will execute his schemes if given a chance. Two, a dissolute rageaholic driven by spasms of emotion, undisciplined, dangerously unpredictable. Of course, the answer is a little of both, and also both are bad, especially in concert with each other, although sometimes one does undo the other. And to be fair to Trump, to be fair to Trump's critics, of which I am one, but I think I try to be a fair one, when both interpretations are available, the temptation is to pick the worse one. But sometimes it's not strategic. Sometimes you see a little of the dissolute guy, and sometimes you see a little of the schemy guy. Donald Trump really did, for instance, try to overturn election results through what we should call evil scheming. But he was also so undisciplined about his scheme and the people he tasked with executing it, it fell apart. Here's another example. Donald Trump really doesn't care about details or staffing. That's distracted, dissolute Donald. But because his criteria for appointing someone is simply fealty to Donald Trump, ego stroking, he appoints a guy like Lickspittle Stephen Miller, and then we get the scheming, plotting policy, which is ultimately a consequence of Donald Trump chaos agent giving way to more lawful evil in Stephen Miller, to use a Dungeons and Dragons turn. Either way is not good. And to show you how fair I am in all of this, I played some clips of him saying Kamala wrong. But his critique of Kamala Harris's anti-price gouging policy, it was accurate. And Kamala Harris's anti-price gouging policy, she said price gouging in a speech today, she was talking about price gouging. It is a terrible application of economics. It's not even economics. It's just some pandering. Don't worry, it's never going to come into effect. I don't know what the it is. It's not a real policy. So on that one, Donald Trump has the better argument. I could say it. And Kamala Harris has the better argument on other issues like abortion, election security, climate change, NATO, civil service protections, and how to pronounce Kamala. That's just my opinion, except the last one, definitely Kamala. On the show today, a two-parter of a great podcast that, just as a podcast, is fascinating. As a document that sheds light on society, it's interesting. I loved listening to the podcast and pondering it. The name of the podcast is Hysterical. The reporter and producer is Dan Taberski, who did the Missing Richard Simmons and Running from Cops podcasts. Dan Taberski, up next. A town in upstate New York called Leroy or Leroy has an outbreak of girls with tics, with verbalizations. It can't be explained. It still makes national news. I read about that story. I don't know that I would be particularly interested in a podcast about that story, except for one thing. The podcast is done by Dan Taberski, and in the pantheon of podcasting greats, you have your Nafax, your Votes, your Koenigs, your Millses, Chase Spiegels. I won't list them all, but Taberski is right up there on the Mount Rushmore. He never fails. The name of the new podcast is Hysterical, or is it? Actually, that is its name, but that is also a line from the podcast. And it's great, as is everything Dan does. Welcome back to The Gist.
Thanks for having me.
So I'll read a line, and this wasn't from the podcast. This is from the New York Times coverage of the event. The ancient Greeks called it hysteria and blamed a wandering uterus. Sigmund Freud deemed the condition conversion and theorized that it was caused by suppressed traumatic experiences. Indeed, both of those explanations show up. I don't know if you read that New York Times story prior to going to Leroy or if it was one of the reports that got you interested in it. But how did you get interested in this story and why?
I got interested in the story because of Havana Syndrome. It didn't start with the story in Leroy. It started with Havana Syndrome a couple years ago. And if you don't know what Havana Syndrome is, it's sort of this disorder that is affecting diplomats and CIA agents and started in Cuba and spread to sort of, I think we're dozens, if not hundreds of places around the world. It's headaches, nausea, tinnitus, hearing loss, all the sort of battery of neurological symptoms that spread among this group. And people were immediately saying that we're making inferences and suggestions that it was an attack, that it was some sort of weapon from Moscow, like some sort of microwave weapon or audio weapon that was being used to attack individual agents, which is a possibility and super fascinating and interesting. But anytime the idea that this might be a mass psychogenic illness came up, everybody just sort of stopped talking about it. And I just thought that was really interesting. I thought it was really interesting that people really weren't willing to countenance the idea that it could be a mass psychogenic illness, that it could be mass hysteria, that it could in some way be from a person's head. And I just started to ask questions about why we weren't really talking about that as a possibility.
And what mass psychogenic illness really means. I mean, there's the definition, but there's also, I think we make the conversion, if you will, to, I think you just said the phrase, all in your head.
Mm-hmm. What is mass psychogenic illness? Is that the question?
Well, that's part of the question, but you said that when people started talking about it as a mass psychogenic illness, that shut the conversation down.
Right.
Part of what your podcast explores
right.
is what mass psychogenic illness really means. Does it really mean, quote, all in your head?
I mean, in some sense, it does. Mass psychogenic illness is stress or trauma that boils over into physical symptoms in one person and then spreads in a tight social group like a school or a convent or a small town. And the symptoms don't have any physical cause. In the case of Leroy, it was motor symptoms. It was tics. It was arms flailing. It was heads twitching. It was verbal outbursts. It was screaming. There were some instances of people hearing a cat meowing. Real intense motor symptoms that didn't have any physical source that doctors could tell. And that spread among these girls.
Yeah.
In the end, up to 19 of them, yeah.
My point was, though, that it's not all in your head. The genic of the psychogenic is it does have physical manifestations in the body. And those aren't just being concocted or aped by the people who are suffering from it.
It is not faking it. It's not malingering. It's not doing something looking for attention. These are actual physical symptoms that cannot be controlled consciously. And there are neurological tests to do this where you can look at brain scans of somebody having these symptoms and you can tell the difference between what's physically real and what is being what isn't real, what is being acted out. And these are all real. So that's the assumption going forward. Even though it's hard for people to get that, the minute you hear that somebody says, oh, maybe it's mass hysteria, maybe it's psychogenic illness, everybody assumes that you're saying it's all in your head.
Who was being affected in Leroy?
In Leroy, it all started with one girl who woke up with a stutter. And she couldn't quite get the words out. She couldn't speak. She was a senior at the high school, cheerleader, and it evolved into physical symptoms like arms flailing, heads twitching, outbursts, tics, verbal tics, motor tics. And a couple weeks later, it spread to her friend.
Her friend.
a friend on the cheerleading squad.
Right. Yes. So cheerleaders got it. Members of the marching band got it. Mm-hmm. It was relegated to certain social groups, yeah. and they couldn't determine if there was a physical proximity to something that these social groups were near that others weren't. It never spread to members of their family. Mm-hmm. So there are, I guess you could say, arguments, and they literally became arguments for mass psychogenic illness or mm-hmm. some cause mm-hmm. that we could point to. And in this town near where you grew up, there were a lot of things that could be causes, it would seem.
Yeah, I mean, what happened in this basically, when something like this is happening and they call the state in and they start to investigate it, it could be a virus, it could be an environmental, it could be some sort of toxin that people are exposed to, or it could be a mass psychogenic illness. And you sort of do water tests and air tests, and they're like, no, everything's fine. But then you realize things like, especially in Western New York, where this is happening, this is 50 miles from Buffalo, where Love Canal happened, which was one of the biggest environmental disasters in our country's history. But you realize that 40 years earlier, 3 miles away from the school, a train had derailed, dumping 35,000 gallons of trichloroethylene solvent into the ground and left a plume that was still in the ground. 40 years later, that had previously, several years before, made dozens of local wells unusable and toxic. And so there was real concern to think that this was a possibility, that it really was an environmental concern, to the point where Erin Brockovich and her team came and started investigating.
Yeah, so that helped, right?
Well, that's the thing about if something is a hysteria, you think something is a mass hysteria, it is really kind of fascinating to watch it spin out of control and watch the sort of social hysteria take over, because you have to solve this problem, right? So there's all these town hall meetings, and Erin Brockovich is running in, and everybody's on the news, you know, formulating, what is this? And I heard that 2-year-olds are also having tics, and I also heard there's this guy next door who has a cancer cluster, and it just becomes this bigger and bigger. And then the cameras come, and then they're filming everything, and then the girls are on TV with their tics, which helps it spread. Because mass psychogenic illness is a line of sight illness. The way it spreads from person to person is by seeing it. So you don't get it by a cough. You don't get it by somebody else's saliva or touching somebody or not washing your hands. It's by seeing it happen. And then you unconsciously pick up those physical symptoms.
Yeah. And then there's a great quote from one of the girls who had it. She said, "Conversion order makes me want to vomit." Yeah. It seems like a lot of the explanations, whether they came from an authority figure and maybe that worked against them, or whether they came from some outside celebrity, or they went on reality TV shows. There was Dr. Drew. There was a show called The Doctors. Mm-hmm. It worked against unraveling the psychogenic illness that was occurring. The more you tell people that you're hysterical, as gendered and fraught as that word yeah. is, the less that they, you know, see, the more they see themselves as embattled and criticized. Sure.
Well, it's also the kind of, it's an illness where it only makes sense, it only works as a diagnosis if you've ruled everything else out. And so there's always that question, have you ruled everything else out?
And you can't, because there are chemicals we don't know about. Exactly. And we're still finding out about microplastics and forever chemicals or something that we didn't test. I mean, there's always that question out there. And what's brilliant about your series is you say to yourself, maybe someone listening to this would say to themselves, okay, so we know what it is and these people just don't get it. But you analyze every other possibility.
Yeah.
What about the times where this exact pattern showed up and there really was something? You mentioned Love Canal.
Yeah.
What about the people who weren't saying, don't you dare call me crazy, it's environmental? You interview someone, the one adult who had it, who really wanted it to be psychogenic yeah. and didn't want it to be environmental.
Yeah, because to her, environmental yeah. meant cancer. To her, environmental yeah. meant death.
Please tell me it was a mass psychogenic
100%.
Illness, and they did, and it didn't help her.
Yeah, and she was also an amazing case, because she was the one adult who got it and came out publicly, although she said that there's at least 6 other adults that she knows of who had it who didn't come forward.
So they were shamed to come out because this was seen as a hysterical teenage TikTok teen.
Yeah, disease. I mean, bizarre. It was bizarre. I mean, and you can hear her tics on the podcast. I mean, they were recorded on the news when she went on the news back then, and I mean, they are violent, violent tics. They're big yelps, shouts, sometimes cursing, arms flailing. It's scary stuff. And so, yeah, I mean, even if people were afraid of them because they were afraid of catching it because it was contagious. It was obviously contagious. It was passing from girl to girl in the school and started getting in the double digits. And after a while, you have to start asking yourself, what is going on? And there were reasons, you know, there's 6 natural gas wells on the school ground property, on the property of the school, and they used to raise money to pay for their heating bills. But fracking wells on school grounds now does not seem like that great an idea.
And 6 of them.
Yeah, 6 of them. And just all these environmental things were real problems. And even if we can't prove that it was one of those things, it's hard to convince a mother that, you know, after a couple of weeks of investigating that you know for sure that it's all in her head. It's really hard to take that diagnosis seriously.
Is the pattern of these things, and you don't just say you concentrate on Leroy, but you also go and investigate an outbreak in Iran. You talk about one in an interesting one, which we'll get to in a second, in Ohio. And then there's Havana syndrome. Is the potential culprit, if it's not the all in your head culprit, the thing that they test or the thing that they worry about, generally the locus of their greatest anxiety? For instance, these girls wouldn't really be worried about foreign adversaries blasting, supersonic rays at them. But a CIA worker would. But a CIA worker probably wouldn't be so anxious about a fracking well on a school or nearby. Right.
I mean, stress or trauma is almost always in the background of these outbreaks. And very often it's an individual stress and trauma. So it could be that somebody's going through something particularly difficult and the stress that they're enduring at that moment boils over into physical symptoms that then spread to other people. But sometimes it's a group trauma. Sometimes, you know, things like shell shock are very similar to mass psychogenic illness, where men were going off to war in a war that was completely technological and violent and deadly in a way that they had never known war before. And they would come back with mutism. They would come back with twitches. They would come back with weird gaits and limps. They would come back with amnesia. They would come back with paralysis. There's one case of a man who had paralysis in his trigger finger. And these are all real. But it's not random. It's because of the group stress of just being involved in that war. And it just shows how vulnerable we all are to the stress that occurs around us.
So we talk about uteruses, uteri, hysteria. We know the etymology of that word. I even use the word gendered, but, and this was a great side a path that you took us on, and not a waste of time at all, the fentanyl outbreak, or the idea that not just ingesting fentanyl, but touching fentanyl could cause physical damage, severe physical damage. That was not among teenage girls. That was among hardened police officers. So fascinating. And it was just like so many of these other ones we're talking about, a panic contagion, right?
And still happening, and still happening. And you can't say for sure. But it certainly appears that there is an outbreak over the past couple of years in the criminal justice system among police officers and court officers and prison officials, that they get near fentanyl. Just the fear of being near fentanyl, perhaps inhaling a little bit or perhaps touching it in the course of a search, that they would then have overdose symptoms in that moment and need Narcan. And we tracked 332 cases so far where this is happening, but toxicologists and experts would tell you that it is essentially impossible for you to overdose on fentanyl. As dangerous as fentanyl and horrible as fentanyl is, it is nearly impossible for you to overdose in that way.
By touching it or exposing it or breathing yourself. Yeah.
Exactly. It's not how fentanyl as a powder aerosolizes.
Yeah. You quote one doctor who says, you know, if someone would fund it, I would roll around in a giant martini glass of fentanyl naked to show that it's not bad. Yeah.
But it's also serious when people overstate how bad it is, and it creates all these knock-on effects where people think they're overdosing, and so then they're afraid to treat people who are overdosing because they don't want to get near it.
Yeah,
there are some municipalities who have made it. They're charging people who have fentanyl on them with assault because they've endangered the police officers that come near them. There are people serving prison time because of assault charges for just carrying fentanyl because they believe that it can hurt you like that when it can't. So it's quite serious. And it's interesting how it spreads in that social group. Like, it's not spreading everywhere else. It's not happening to people who use fentanyl. It's not happening to nurses. It's not happening to doctors. It's happening in the criminal justice system. And because it is a line of sight illness, mass psychogenic illness spreads when you hear about it or see it happening, and then it ends up happening to you. Because of body cams, we see all these overdoses or alleged overdoses on body cam video. And they put them on the news saying another secondhand fentanyl overdose. And then everybody sees them, including police officers. And so it's this perfect vector for spread. It's really a fascinating story.
In the fentanyl part of your series, you had an expert saying pretty plainly, well, someone pointed out that doctors and nurses handle fentanyl all the time and have for decades. And nothing happens to them. And that person said, it was a really good point. It was sort of non-rebuttable. Was there an absence of that point, or couldn't you make a similar point to the girls in Leroy or any of the other people, maybe the Havana syndrome, that this doesn't make sense because, you know, none of your non-teenage girlfriends are getting it, Marcy, the 36-year-old, right, accepted, or any other logical argument that was as strong as that?
I think the problem ends up being, and I think what happened in Leroy, is that any logical problem you have about the cause of a contagion is about the group, right? It's about, you guys all have the same, this is happening to 19 people, you all have the same symptoms, here's how it, like, we know it's this. But the minute you start going down to the individual person, everybody has their own individual comorbidities, their own individual circumstances, their own individual stress and trauma, their own history with being not believed by doctors, right? That's why you can look at something from a 30,000 foot level and say that was mass hysteria. But on a person-to-person level, it's really hard to convince something that what they believe their own medical experience to be is not true. And it's almost not right to make them. Everybody should be able to just sort of be able to describe their own medical experience, right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't always mean it's necessarily empirically true.
And we'll be back more with Dan Taberski in about a minute. Back with Dan Taberski, whose new podcast, Hysterical, is about a mysterious illness spreading through high school girls in Leroy, New York. And Dan, you contrast what happened in Leroy with the town of Danvers, Massachusetts. And in Danvers, there was a similar outbreak, but the town pretty much downplayed it. There were no news trucks, and it went away. The supposed symptoms didn't really amount to anything. The implication in so much of our national conversation about mental health, to take it larger, is that attention must be paid. We need to raise awareness. We have this mental health crisis, and what we need to do is pay attention to it. But, you know, I interviewed Abigail Schreier. We agreed on some things, disagreed on others. But she writes a lot about the cost of raising awareness. And sometimes the cost of raising awareness is incentivizing or subsidizing, if you will, more mental health, supposed mental health problems. So, considering the Danvers handling of the outbreak, what do you do with the worry that raising awareness could hurt more than it helps?
What do you mean that it can have costs? Like, explain that parallel.
If you raise awareness, if you hyper-raise awareness, if you tell everyone that this that you're experiencing needs Aaron Brockovich to examine it and Drew Pinsky to do segments about it and it to get all the attention in the world, it only gets worse. You had the expert who talked about every exacerbation of this was the more attention it got. The more awareness, the worse it got. It's not always the right solution to raise awareness. But what do you do about a national mental health problem?
It's an intractable problem that once a hysterical illness begins, you can watch the sort of cultural mass hysteria happen. And it's almost impossible to stop. You can't ask people to not investigate because the things that the attention makes it worse. The attention always makes it worse. It makes the symptoms demonstrably worse. And we were able to show that in Leroy. And as the hysteria went on, as the reporting got bigger and bigger, and as more people were covering it, as more news vans showed up, this not only did more people get ill, but the symptoms got worse. So the symptoms began to evolve from having tics and outbursts, and they evolved to girls passing out. And so they would have syncable events, and they would have them on television. They had them on Dr. Drew. They had them on. They would literally have them on TV as they were talking about this illness. And so it's just one of the fascinating things about hysteria, that our role in it. And I don't know that there's an answer. I don't know that there's a fix. I think just the knowing what our role is helpful and interesting.
If we know post hoc that it is hysteria, that seems the right answer. But if we don't know if it might be an environmental contagion, if it's ambiguous at the time, what do we do? And so that's why I wanted to ask you about this in regards to teen depression, increasing risks or the connection, the Jonathan Haidt quote unquote connection. I might be throwing too much shade on what I think is a generally sound theory of kids, depression, and access to social media. Is some of the answer, we got to pay less attention to this?
Here's what I think. When you're looking at what caused the hysteria in Leroy, New York, what stress or trauma, if any, if this was a mass hysteria, what the stress or trauma was that caused it, you can't say for sure, but I don't think it's a coincidence that this happened in 2012. And I think that being a girl in 2012 in high school began to change pretty precipitously around then. And I think now...
Social media, you're pointing
think,
to the...
Yeah, I think now looking media, back, yeah. Now looking back, if you look at all that, we didn't know it then, but now 2012, like that's when teenage girls, levels of depression in teenage girls began to go up and anxiety. And that's when social media came out, and that's where people were living on Instagram and Facebook. And it was completely changing their minds and how they were able to react to stress and 100%. I can't draw a direct connection to that, but I mean, I don't think it's crazy to say that that's a part of what was potentially happening in that school. Not to mention how hard it is to just be in high school, period. And also not to mention that once a mass hysteria starts, once a mass psychogenic illness starts spreading, it becomes its own stress and trauma. Like the minute you're in a high school where there's a contagious illness spreading that nobody knows where it is, where it's coming from and why it's happening and it's spreading, like it... The hysteria it takes care of itself. You're afraid of the thing. It's really fascinating. It's really fascinating.
It really is.
Yeah.
One of the things that you do is you treat your subjects, the people you interview, and this is genuine, with extreme sensitivity. And the point is not to say you were just hysterical or it was just all in your head. It was real. And we have to realize it's important for you that the audience realizes and sympathizes with them.
Yeah.
By the same token, you definitely do not endorse a default to subjectivity, right? Your answer is not that maybe their truth was that there was a actual problem, but our truth is from measuring toxin levels, there isn't. Because it's somewhat important to you, or if you can articulate why, either as a journalist or person, to point out the actual facts, even if we're forgiving of those people who, however they experience those facts.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated with something like mass psychogenic illness in that you can never, because it's pretty much a diagnosis of exclusion, you can never quite say 100% that it was mass psychogenic illness, because there's always potentially something that you don't know about. There are tons of diseases, especially for women, that women have had that they said, oh, that's hysterical, that's hysteria, that's all in your head. And then 100 years later, they realize, oh, no, that's because of this certain thing. So that sort of thing happens all the time. And I think
okay, so that's the humility part of it, right? You can't be so certain. But at the same time, you do have that line about, you know, we can't live in a place where different worlds seem to have different facts.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, you have to respect people and the experience that they think they're having. And it is hard in a time where you talk about lived experience, right? Where people are expressing what they're going through, and like you have to give that credence. They're telling you what's happening to them. But just because somebody says what's happening to them and believes it doesn't necessarily mean it's true. And so there's a way to thread that needle, to hear people and give them the respect that they deserve. And it's not about finger pointing or making fun of anybody, but it's also acknowledging that we're not always the best judges of what's happening to ourselves.
Was there ever a temptation? I think for many journalists, it would be an easy out to say, or to rest on, I guess we'll never know, to default to subjectivity, to say that, you know, the only thing that we can agree on is the uncertainty, that sort of thing. You don't open yourself up, I suppose, to criticism if that's your conclusion.
I mean, I don't think it's subject. I think at a 30,000 foot level, I think what happened in that town was mass hysteria. And incredibly rare. the type of mass hysteria it was incredibly rare. For it to happen for that long with those symptoms being so severe to spread to so many people is remarkable. But I do believe it was a mass psychogenic illness. That being said, I talked to people who had the symptoms, and they also had comorbidities that explained parts of it. There were other things going on medically that could have explained other parts of it. And so it is also possible that, you know, that somebody was part of a mass hysteria, but not all of it was in their head. Part of it was in their head. That part of it was psychological or psychogenic, but that there were symptoms that were real that went along with it. So it's always a mixed bag. It's never black or white.
I appreciate how your series always focuses on the subject, and then the resonances, cultural resonances or analogies, those almost always get explored too. And so often you anticipate the things I'm talking about. I was thinking about Havana syndrome as I was listening to this, and then it shows up. There's another reason why The Girls and Leroy specifically, or other instances of mass hysteria, social contagion, get brought up, and that is with the trans debate. And some people, mostly conservatives, say that, and you know, some researchers, that we should at least take seriously the idea that there might be a social contagion component to that. I don't know. Were you tempted to tackle this at all, or do you just like your career too much?
Was I tempted to tackle that? No. The parallels don't really work for me there. As one psychoanalyst put it to me, a lot of this boils down to what happens in our bodies and what happens in our minds and what happens in the world are all connected in ways that we don't always understand. And I think for me, that's enough. I certainly don't think it transfers over to the trans debate or anything like that. But it also makes me have a little more humility around any medical, cultural, or psychological issue. That it's always a combination of things. It's always complicated. And I think if anything, that's what this project is trying to point out.
Do you know that part of that Simpsons episode where Miss Hoover writes on the board, "My Lyme disease was psychosomatic," and then Ralph says, "Does that mean he went crazy?" And someone else says, "No, it means she was faking it." And Miss Hoover says, "No, actually, it was a little of both."
No, oh, that's hilarious.
I don't mean to reduce your brilliant 8-part series to a 12-second clip on The Simpsons, but how truthful or how accurate was Miss Hoover being in that moment?
Not the faking part. Nobody was doing anything near faking. That is for sure. I think the role of the unconscious in this and the role of the unconscious in controlling your body is incredible. And it's really hard to believe. And it's really, really easy to slip into, were they faking it? And maybe they were a little bit. Maybe they were getting something out of it. Maybe they were looking for attention. And it just doesn't pan out. And I think that's what makes it so fascinating. To know that it's not just you're believing that they're not faking it. Like, you can tell medically, you can tell with tests when they're faking it and when they're not. And to know that they're not, that this is real, these symptoms are real, to me, that's what makes it, like, infinitely more interesting.
How long do you spend on a series like this?
About a year and a half. This was about a year and a half.
And how many people are also spending a year and a half? You mentioned your fact checker. I know at some point, producers and editors get involved.
Always. I have a couple of producers, a couple of editors, definitely fact checker. I have a pretty healthy team. This is a lot of work. And the producers I'm working with are doing a lot of the basic, boots on the ground journalism at the beginning, in terms of reaching out to all these people sensitively and just doing all the research that goes into something like this. It requires a relatively large team as far as podcasts go, but I'm greedy that way. I like it.
Well, you know all the compliments I gave you in the beginning. Do you think the state of the kind of podcasting you do, the deeply reported one, is healthy right now? Give me your state of the industry.
Nothing feels healthy to me right now. Nothing in the world feels healthy to me right now.
I mean, if you were running a streaming service, you'd probably say, yeah, Netflix is doing pretty good. There are a couple things, right?
Yeah.
An NBA expansion team would probably be a good bet.
Even my ability to make a project that I'm really proud of right now that requires considerable resources for podcasts and staff and time and all that stuff, like just the fact that we were able to do it feels amazing. But I am aware that these are becoming harder and harder to make. But it's also kind of not my problem. Like, I'm not a business person. I work with producers who, I mean, I am a business person, I guess, but like, I'm not the one who knows how to do that the best. I think what I know how to do is lead projects like this, and I love it. And so I just hope I get to keep doing it.
Dan Taberski's new podcast from Pineapple Studios is called Hysterical. Thanks so much, Dan.
My pleasure. Always good to talk to you.
Always good. That's it for today's show. The show is produced by the Quaint Mallards. Corey Warr is the producer and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca spearheads special projects for us at Peachfish. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Mpuru, Gpuru, Dupuru, and thanks for listening.